Rule 115, Rights of Accused, Section 1, Rights of Accused at the Trial. In all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall be entitled to the following rights. A. To be presumed innocent until the contrary is proved beyond reasonable doubt. B. To be informed of the nature and cause of the accusation against him. C. To be present and defend in person and by counsel at every stage of the proceedings, from arraignment to promulgation of the judgment. The accused may, however, waive his presence at the trial pursuant to the stipulation set forth in his bail unless his presence is specifically ordered by the court for purposes of identification. The absence of the accused without justifiable cause at the trial, of which he had notice, shall be considered a waiver of his right to be present thereat. When an accused under custody escapes, he shall be deemed to have waived his right to be present on all subsequent trial dates until custody over him is regained. Upon motion, the accused may be allowed to defend himself in person when it sufficiently appears to the court that he can properly protect his rights without assistance of counsel. Letter D. To testify as a witness in his own behalf but subject to cross-examination on matters covered by direct examination. His silence shall not in any manner prejudice him. E. To be exempt from being compelled to be a witness against himself. F. To confront and cross-examine the witnesses against him at the trial. Either party may utilize as part of its evidence the testimony of a witness who is deceased out of or can not with due diligence be found in the Philippines unavailable or otherwise unable to testify given in another case or proceeding, judicial or administrative involving the same parties in subject matter, the adverse party having the opportunity to cross-examine him. G. To have compulsory process issued to secure the attendance of witnesses and production of other evidence in his behalf. H. To have speedy, impartial, and public trial. I. To appeal in all cases allowed and in the manner prescribed by law. Constitutional rights of the accused. Apart from the rights of the accused in the trial as provided in the above rule, he has the following rights provided for by no less than the Constitution, to wit, Section 14. Number 1. No person shall be held to answer for a criminal offense without due process of law. Number 2. In all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall be presumed innocent until the contrary is proved and shall enjoy the right to be heard by himself and counsel, to be informed of the nature and cause of the accusation against him, to have a speedy, impartial, and public trial, to meet the witness face to face, and to have compulsory process to secure the attendance of witnesses and the production of evidence in his behalf. However, after arraignment, trial may proceed notwithstanding the absence of the accused, provided that he has been duly notified and his failure to appear is unjustifiable. Purpose of the rule. The constitutional rights granted to an accused and implemented by the rules are intended to assure a full and unimpeded opportunity for him to meet what in the end could be a baseless accusation. A. Presumption of innocence. The accused shall be entitled to the right to be presumed innocent until the contrary is proved beyond reasonable doubt. It is on this basis that in the order of trial, the prosecution is required to present its evidence ahead of the defense. The presumption of innocence is not a mere procedural tool of the law. It is not overcome by the presumption of regularity. Indeed, it can be rebutted only by proof beyond reasonable doubt, nor can it be overcome by mere suspicion or conjecture. A probability that the accused committed the crime or that he had the opportunity to do so. The prosecution must overthrow the presumption of innocence with proof of guilt beyond reasonable doubt. The proof against him must survive the test of reason. The strongest suspicion must not be permitted to sway judgment. In order to convict an accused, the circumstances of the case must exclude all and each and every hypothesis consistent with his innocence. In offenses involving the capital punishment, the presumption of innocence takes an even more paramount significance. It is safely entrenched in our jurisprudence that unless the prosecution discharges its burden to prove the guilt of the accused beyond reasonable doubt, the latter need not even offer evidence in his behalf. Thus, in the case, it was held that the trial court, in convicting the accused, cannot accord full faith and credence to testify to the testimony of the police officer who was presumed to have performed his duty in a regular manner, while law enforcers enjoy the presumption of regularity in the performance of their duties, this presumption cannot prevail over the constitutional right of the accused to be presumed innocent, and it cannot by itself constitute proof of guilt beyond reasonable doubt. Proof of identity of accused. In every criminal prosecution, the identity of the offender or offenders, like the crime itself, must be established by proof beyond reasonable doubt. Identification which does not preclude a reasonable possibility of mistake cannot be accorded any evidentiary force. In the absence of proof beyond reasonable doubt as to the identity of the culprit, the accused constitutional right of presumption of innocence until the contrary is proved is not overcome, and he is entitled to an acquittal even though his innocence may be doubted. The constitutional presumption of innocence guaranteed to every individual is of primary importance, and the conviction of the accused must rest not on the weakness of the defense but on the strength of the evidence for the prosecution. Let there be a right to be informed of the nature and cause of accusation. Section 14.2. Article 3 of the 1987 Constitution provides that in all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall enjoy the right to be informed of the nature and cause of the accusation against him. The accused is solemnly and ceremonially informed of the nature and cause of the accusation against him during the arraignment, in which a copy of the information is furnished to him and the same is read to him in a language or dialect known to him. In the old case of U.S. versus Carlson, the Supreme Court explained the heart of this constitutional guarantee, that the object of this written accusation was first to furnish the accused with such a description of the charge against him as will enable him to make his defense, and second, to avail himself of his conviction or acquittal for protection against a further prosecution for the same cause, and third, to inform the court of the facts alleged so that it may decide whether they are sufficient in law to support a conviction if one should be had. It must be borne in mind that the requirement for complete allegations in the particulars of the indictment is based on the right of the accused to be fully informed of the nature of the charges against him so that he may adequately prepare for his defense pursuant to the due process clause of the Constitution. The accused is presumed to have no independent knowledge of the facts that constitute the offense. The Hornbook Doctrine, thus, in our jurisdiction is that an accused cannot be convicted of an offense unless it is clearly charged in the complaint or information, for constitutionally he has a right to be informed of the nature and cause of the accusation against him. Hence, in a case it was held that an accused cannot be convicted under paragraph 2 or 3 of Article 335 of the Revised Penal Code in an information charging him with the rape by the use of force or intimidation, because none of these modes of committing rape, when the woman is deprived of reason or otherwise unconscious, or when the woman is under 12 years of age, were alleged in the information. The rationale for this rule is that to convict him under either of these statutory provisions is to deprive him of the constitutional right to be informed of the accusation against him. So too, where the accused is a deaf mute, the absence of a qualified interpreter in a sign language and of any other means, whether in writing or otherwise, to inform the accused of the charges against him, denied the accused his fundamental right to due process of law. The accuracy and fairness of the factual process by which the guilt or innocence of the accused was determined was not safeguarded. The accused could not be said to have enjoyed the right to be heard by himself and counsel, and to be informed of the nature and cause of the accusation against him in the proceedings where his life and liberty were at stake. See right to counsel. The accused is entitled to the right to be present and defend in person and by counsel at every stage of the proceedings, from arraignment to promulgation of judgment. This right is further provided for in and being implemented by Section 6, 7, and 8, Rule 116, Section 13, Rule 122, and Section 2, Rule 124 of the Rules. Under the revised guidelines for continuous trial of criminal cases, if a party fails to qualify for the availment of the services of the public attorney's office, the Integrated Bar of the Philippines Local Chapter shall provide free legal assistance to said party for this purpose. The IBP Local Chapter shall submit to the executive judges a list of IBP local lawyers who may be appointed by the courts to act as counsel to officials in such cases. The list shall be disseminated among all the trial courts in the station. Incidentally, the right to a hearing carries with it the right to be notified of every incident of the proceedings in court. Notice to a party is essential to enable him to adduce his own evidence and meet and refute the evidence submitted by the other party. As a rule, where a party appears by attorney in an action or proceeding in a court of record, all notices required to be given therein must be given to the attorney of record. Basis of the right to counsel. The right to counsel proceeds from the fundamental principle of due process, which basically means that the person must be heard before being condemned. The due process requirement is a part of a person's basic right. It is not a mere formality that may be dispensed with or performed perfunctorily. The accused needs the aid of counsel lest he be the victim of overzealous prosecutors, of the law's complexity, or of his own ignorance or bewilderment. Accordingly, an accused may exercise his right to counsel by electing to be represented either by a court-appointed lawyer or by one of his own choice, informing and asking the accused. Before arraignment, the court shall inform the accused of his right to counsel and ask him if he desires to have one. Unless the accused is allowed to defend himself in person or has employed counsel of his choice, the court must assign a counsel de officio to defend him. In ensuring the right to counsel, it is not enough that the accused is informed of such right. He should also be asked if he wants to avail of the same and should be told that he could ask for counsel if he so desires or that one could be provided for him at his request. Scope of the right to counsel. The right to counsel must be more than just the presence of a lawyer in the courtroom or the mere propounding of standard questions and objections. The right to counsel means that the accused is amply accorded legal assistance extended by a counsel who commits himself to the cause for the defense and acts accordingly. The right assumes an active involvement by the lawyer in the proceedings, particularly at the trial of the case, is bearing constantly in mind of the basic rights of the accused, is being well-versed on the case, and is knowing the fundamental procedures, essential laws, and existing jurisprudence. The right of an accused to counsel finds substance in the performance by the lawyer of his sworn duty of fidelity to his client. Tersely put, it means an efficient and truly decisive legal assistance and not a simple perfunctory representation. Presence of counsel. The presence and participation of counsel in criminal proceedings should never be taken lightly. Even the most intelligent or educated man may have no skill in the science of the law, particularly in the rules of procedure, and without counsel, he may be convicted not because he is guilty, but because he does not know how to establish his innocence. And this can happen more easily to persons who are ignorant or uneducated. It is for this reason that the right to be assisted by counsel is deemed so important that it has become a constitutional right, and it is so implemented that under our rules of procedure, it is not enough for the court to apprise an accused of his right to have an attorney. It is not enough to ask him whether he desires the aid of an attorney, but it is essential that the court should assign one de officio for him if he so desires and he is poor, or grant him a reasonable time to procure an attorney of his own. Indeed, the right to counsel is of such primordial importance that even if an accused was represented by three successive counsels from the public attorney's office, the Supreme Court has ordered the remand of a rape case. When it found that the accused was given more perfunctory representation by aforesaid counsel, such that appellant was not properly and effectively accorded the right to counsel. In the case of People v. Bermas, the High Court admonished three POW lawyers for failing to genuinely protect the interests of the accused and for having fallen much too short of their responsibility as officers of the court and as members of the bar. Verily, the court can do no less where the accused was not even duly represented by a certified member of the Philippine bar, no matter how zealous his representation might have been. So, to an accused is denied his right to counsel, where he could not understand and communicate with his counsel he was provided with concerning his defense. An accused was denied of due process where the successive non-appearance of his counsel in the four settings despite notice was construed as a waiver of his right to present evidence under People v. Diaz, but there is no denial of the right to counsel where counsel de officio was appointed during the absence of the accused counsel departed pursuant to the court's desire to finish the case as early as practicable under the continuous trial system in the case of Amion v. Chongson. Limitation on the right. While the accused's right to be represented by counsel is immutable, his option to secure the service of counsel departed is not, however, absolute. The court is obliged to balance the privilege to retain a counsel of choice against the state's and the offended party's equally important right to speedy and adequate justice. Thus, the court may restrict the accused's option to retain a counsel departed if the accused insists on an attorney he cannot afford, or the chosen counsel is not a member of the bar, or the attorney declines to represent the accused for a valid reason, example, conflict of interest or the like, or his insistence on acquiring the services of counsel de parte was merely a strategy to prolong the proceedings of the case. So where the accused insisted on being represented by an American citizen with no authority from the Supreme Court to practice law and who was prohibited by the trial court from appearing before it, and said the accused took advantage of the short memory of the court due to the assignment of a new judge, there is no basis to invalidate the proceedings, it appearing that the accused was neither prejudiced nor deprived of his right to counsel. In the case of People versus Janeiro. C. Right to be heard in defense. The accused is also entitled to the right to be present and defend in person by counsel at every stage of the proceedings, from arraignment to promulgation of the judgment. Corollary to this, he has the right to testify as a witness in his own behalf, but subject to cross-examination on matters covered by direct examination. The constitutional right of the accused to be heard in his defense is inviolate. No court of justice under our system of government has the power to deprive him of that right. The right of an accused during trial are given paramount importance in our laws and rules in criminal procedure. Among the fundamental rights of the accused is the right to be heard by himself and counsel. Verily, this right is even guaranteed by the Constitution itself. Thus, in the trial, the accused may present evidence to prove his defense and damages, if any, arising from the issuance of any provisional remedy in the case. Right to present evidence waivable. The right to present evidence in defense may be waived expressly or impliedly. In a case, it was held that there was no waiver of the right where the postponements sought by accused and counsel appeared to be justified and were not vexatious and oppressive as borne by the record of the case. The intention and the willingness of the accused to present evidence can be gleaned from the fact that he had already presented one witness and has other witnesses ready for presentation. Although this was delayed for meritorious reasons, such as his illness and his counsel, his confinement at a hospital, ongoing negotiations between the parties, and substitution of counsel. C. Right to be present. The accused is also entitled to the right to be present at every stage of the proceedings, from arraignment to promulgation of the judgment. The accused may, however, waive his presence at the trial pursuant to the stipulation set forth in his bail, unless his presence is specifically ordered by the court for purposes of identification. The absence of the accused without justifiable cause at the trial of which he had notice shall be considered a waiver of his right to be present thereat. When an accused under custody escapes, he shall be deemed to have waived his right to be present on all subsequent trial dates until custody over him is regained. Upon motion, the accused may be allowed to defend himself in person when it sufficiently appears to the court that he can properly protect his rights without the assistance of counsel. When presence cannot be waived, while the accused may waive his presence at the trial, the constitutional provision authorizing trials in absentia does not allow the accused to be absent at certain stages of the proceedings, to wit, letter A, at arraignment and plea, whether of innocence or guilt, letter B, during trial whenever necessary for identification purposes, and letter C, at the promulgation of sentence, unless it is for a light offense, in which case the accused may appear by counsel or representative. At such stages of the proceedings, his presence is required and cannot be waived. Letter D, right to testify in his behalf. Corollary to the right to be heard in defense, the accused is entitled to the right to testify as a witness in his own behalf, but subject to cross-examination on matters covered by direct examination, his silence shall not in any manner prejudice him. Right against self-incrimination. The accused shall be entitled to the right to be exempt from being compelled to be a witness against himself. The accused may refuse to take the witness stand. It is settled that he can refuse at the outset and altogether to take the stand as a witness for the prosecution under reasonable assumption that the purpose of his interrogation will be to incriminate him. The accused occupies a different tier of protection from an ordinary witness, whereas an ordinary witness may be compelled to take the witness stand and claim the privilege against self-incrimination, as each question requiring an incriminating answer is shot at him. An accused may altogether refuse to take the witness stand and refuse to answer any and all questions. The rule possibly intends to avoid and prohibit the certainly inhuman procedure of compelling a person to furnish the missing evidence necessary for his conviction. The accused, however, who takes the witness stand and offer testimony on his behalf, effectively waives his right against self-incrimination. He may thus be cross-examined on matters covered by direct examination. He may be asked incriminating questions on any matter he testified to on direct examination. scope of the right. The constitutional right of an accused against self-incrimination prescribes the use of physical or moral compulsion to extort communications from the accused, and not the inclusion of his body in evidence when it may be material. Purely mechanical acts are not included in the prohibition, as the accused did not thereby speak his guilt, hence the assistance and guiding hand of counsel is not required. The essence of the right against self-incrimination is testimonial compulsion, that is, the giving of evidence against himself through a testimonial act. Hence, it has been held that the woman charged with adultery may be compelled to submit to physical examination to determine her pregnancy, and an accused may be compelled to submit to physical examination and to have a substance taken from his body for medical determination as to whether he was suffering from gonorrhea, which was contracted by him, by his victim, to expel morphine from his mouth, to have the outline of his foot traced to determine his identity with bloody footprints, and to be photographed or measured, or his garments or shoes removed or replaced, or to move his body to enable the foregoing things to be done. In a case, the accused and his companions were arrested in connection with the enforcement of a search warrant in his residence, in which shabu materials and paraphernalia were found. They were also asked to give urine samples, which yielded positive results for the presence of prohibited drugs. The Supreme Court held that the taking of the urine samples fall among the exemptions under the freedom from testimonial compulsion, since what was sought to be examined came from the body of the accused. But in another case, the accused was arrested for extortion, refused to have his urine extracted and tested for drugs, and requested for a lawyer prior to his urine test. It was held that the drug test was a violation of his right to privacy and right against self-incrimination. The prohibition against self-incrimination applies to the compulsion for the production of documents, papers, and chattels that may be used as evidence against the accused, except where the state has a right to inspect the same, such as the books of accounts of corporations under the police power. It also protects the accused against any attempt to compel him to furnish a specimen of his handwriting in connection with his prosecution for falsification, because it would furnish a means to determine whether or not he is the falsifier. F. Right of confrontation and cross-examination. The accused has the right to confront and cross-examine the witnesses against him at the trial. Either party may utilize as part of its evidence the testimony of a witness who is deceased, out of or cannot with due diligence be found in the Philippines, unable or otherwise unable to testify, given in another case or proceeding judicial or administrative involving the same parties and subject matter, the adverse party having the opportunity to cross-examine him. The constitutional right of confrontation, which guarantees to the accused the right to cross-examine the witnesses for the prosecution, is one of the most basic rights of an accused person under our system of justice. It is a fundamental right which is part of due process, not only in criminal proceedings but also in civil proceedings, as well as in proceedings in administrative tribunals with quasi-judicial powers. It being a fundamental right of every accused, it may not be summarily done away with. Purposes of the right. The accused is granted the right of confrontation for two purposes. First, to secure the opportunity of cross-examination, and second, to allow the judge to observe the deportment and appearance of the witness while testifying. Stated otherwise, it ensures that the witness will give his testimony under oath, thus deterring lying by the threat of perjury charge. It forces the witness to submit to cross-examination of valuable instrument and exposing falsehood and bringing out the truth, and it enables the court to observe demeanor of the witness and assess his credibility. Waiver of the right. But while the right to confrontation and cross-examination is a fundamental right, the same can be waived expressly or impliedly by conduct amounting to a renunciation of the right of cross-examination. The conduct of a party which may be construed as an implied waiver of the right of cross-examination may take various forms, but the common basic principles underlying the application of the rule on the implied waiver is that the party was given the opportunity to confront and cross-examine an opposing witness but failed to take advantage of it for a reason attributable to himself alone. Thus, where a party has had the opportunity to cross-examine an opposing witness but failed to avail himself of it, he necessarily forfeits the right to cross-examine, and the testimony given on direct examination of the witness will be received or allowed to remain in the record. So too, an accused who escaped from detention and who has been tried in absentia does not retain his rights to cross-examine and to present evidence on his behalf. By his failure to appear during the trial of which he had notice, he virtually waived these rights. It is also recognized that sometimes it is impossible to recall or produce a witness who has already testified in a previous proceeding, in which event his previous testimony is made admissible as a distinct piece of evidence by way of exception to the hearsay rule. The previous testimony is made admissible because it makes the administration of justice orderly and expeditious. So too, the right of confrontation is not violated where the accused counsel was not present during the direct examination of the prosecution witness, so long as said counsel was given the opportunity to cross-examine him. Effects of absence of or incomplete cross-examination. The effects of absence of an incomplete cross-examination of witness and admissibility in evidence of his testimony on direct examination has been extensively discussed by the Supreme Court through Justice McCaskier in the case of People v. Cisneros. Thus, as a general rule, the testimony of a witness given on direct examination should be stricken where there is not an adequate opportunity for cross-examination, as where the witness, by reason of his death, illness, or absence, cannot be subjected to cross-examination. Although the contrary has been held, the testimony of a witness given on direct examination should be stricken where there is not an adequate opportunity for cross-examination, as where the party against whom he testified is, through no fault of his own, deprived of the right to cross-examine him by reason of his death, or as a result of the illness of the witness or absence, or a mistrial ordered. The direct testimony of a witness who dies before conclusion of the cross-examination can be stricken only insofar as not covered by the cross-examination, and absence of a witness is not enough to warrant striking his testimony for failure to appear for further cross-examination, where the witness has already been sufficiently cross-examined, or the matter on which further cross-examination is sought is not in controversy. It has been held that a referee has no power to strike the examination of a witness on his failure to appear for cross-examination, where a good excuse is given. Moreover, if one is deprived of the opportunity for cross-examination without fault upon his part, as in the case of the illness or death of a witness after direct examination, it is generally held that he is entitled to have the direct testimony stricken from the record. This doctrine rests in the common law rule that no evidence should be admitted but what was or might be under the examination of both parties, and that ex parte statements are too uncertain and unreliable to be considered in the investigation of converted facts. It has been held, however, that the trial court did not abuse its discretion in refusing to discharge the jury where the state witness collapsed before cross-examination was completed, it being shown that no motion to strike the testimony was made, that it was not indicated what further information was sought to be produced by further cross-examination, and that the witness testimony was largely cumulative. And thus, where the prosecution witness was already partly cross-examined, but prior to the next hearing, he was shot dead while trying to escape from jail, his testimony cannot be stricken off the record. G. Right to compulsory process. Enshrined in the Constitution is the paramount right of the accused to have a compulsory process to secure the attendance of witnesses and the production of evidence in his behalf. Procedural due process cannot possibly be satisfied without a law which hears before it condemns, which proceeds upon inquiry and renders judgment only after trial. The constitutional right of the accused to be heard on his defense is inviolate. No court of justice under our system of government has the power to deprive him of that right. In implementing this constitutional guarantee, the rules provide that the accused shall be entitled to a compulsory process issued to secure the attendance of witnesses and production of other evidence in his behalf. The trial court should not delegate to the accused the responsibility of getting his witnesses. The court should subpoena a defense witness if the accused should ask for it. An accused is denied his right to have compulsory process where he was not provided the services of a qualified and competent interpreter to enable him to present his testimony. Process is available to accused. The compulsory process is available to the accused in order to secure the attendance of witnesses or the production of other evidence are the following. A. Subpoena ad testificandum. It is a process directed to a person requiring him to attend and testify at the hearing or the trial of an action or at any investigation conducted by the competent authority or for taking of his deposition. Letter B, subpoena duces tecum. It is a process requiring a person to bring with him any books, documents, or other things under his control. Letter C, production or inspection of material evidence in possession of prosecution upon motion of the accused showing good cause and with notice to the parties to court in order to prevent surprise. Suppression or alteration may order the prosecution to produce and permit the inspection and copying or photographing of any written statement given by the complainant and other witnesses in any investigation of the offense conducted by the prosecution or other investigating officers, as well as any designated documents, papers, books, accounts, letters, photographs, objects, or tangible things not otherwise privileged which constitute or contain evidence material to any matter involved in a case and which are in the possession or under the control of the prosecution, police, or other law investigating agencies. Letter D, application for examination of witness for accused before trial. When the accused has been held to answer for an offense, he may, upon motion with notice to the other parties, have witnesses conditionally examined in his behalf. Letter H, right to speedy trial. The accused shall be entitled to a speedy, impartial, and public trial. The Constitution likewise mandates dispatch, not only in the trial stage, but also in the disposition thereof, warranting dismissals in cases of violation thereof without the fault of the party concerned, not only the accused. However, the right of an accused to a speedy trial should not be utilized to deprive the state of a reasonable opportunity of fairly indicting criminals. Hence, certain factors are considered and balanced against each other in answering the judicial inquiry as to whether such right was violated. The right to speedy trial is further provided by RA 8493, the Speedy Trial Act of 1998, and implemented by Sections 1 to 10 of Rule 119 of the Rules. Limitation of the right to speedy trial. The right of an accused to a speedy trial is guaranteed to him by the Constitution, but the same shall not be utilized to deprive the state of a reasonable opportunity of fairly indicting criminals. It secures rights to a defendant, but it does not preclude the rights of public justice. While the Supreme Court recognizes the right to speedy disposition quite distinctly from the right to a speedy trial, and although the court has always zealously espoused protection from oppressive and vexatious delays not attributable to the party involved, at the same time, the High Court held that the party's individual rights should not work against and preclude the people's equally important right to public justice. Factors to be considered. The doctrinal rule is that in the determination of whether or not that right has been violated, the factors that may be considered and balanced are the length of delay, the reasons for such delay, the assertion or failure to assert such right by the accused, and the prejudice caused by the delay. A mere mathematical reckoning of the time involved, therefore, would not be sufficient. In the application of the constitutional guarantee of the right to speedy disposition of cases, particular regard must also be taken of the facts and circumstances peculiar to each case. Right to speedy trial waivable. The right to a speedy trial, as any other right conferred by the Constitution or statute, except when otherwise expressly so provided by law, may be waived. It must therefore be asserted. When right to speedy trial deemed violated. Well establishes the doctrine that the right to a speedy trial is violated only where there is an unreasonable, vexatious, and oppressive delay without participation or fault of the accused, or when unjustified postponements are sought which prolong the trial for an unreasonable length of time. Equally applicable is the balancing test used to determine whether the defendant has been denied his right to a speedy trial or a speedy disposition of a cause for that matter, in which the conduct of both the prosecution and the defendant are weighed, and such factors as length of the delay, reason for the delay, the defendant's assertion or non-assertion of his right, and prejudice to the defendant resulting from the delay are considered. The desideratum of a speedy disposition of cases should not, if at all possible, result in the precipitate loss of a party's right to present evidence, and either in a plaintiff's being non-suited, the defendant's being pronounced liable under an ex parte judgment. Thus, it was held that there was no violation of the right to speedy trial, where it took the ombudsman more than 3 years to elapse from the filing of the complaint on August 25, 1986, up to the filing of the information on November 5, 1990, in Castillo v. Sandigan Bayan. H, right to impartial and public trial. The accused has the right to an impartial and public trial. However, the judge may motu proprio exclude the public from the courtroom if the evidence to be produced during the trial is offensive to decency or public morals. He may also, on motion of the accused, exclude the public from the trial except court personnel and the counsel of the parties. Then and now, it has been ruled that the right of an accused to a fair trial is not incompatible to a free press. To be sure, responsible reporting enhances an accused's right to a fair trial, for as well pointed out, the responsible press has always been regarded as the handmaiden of effective judicial administration, especially in the criminal field. The press does not simply publish information about trials, but guards against the miscarriage of justice by subjecting the police, prosecutors, and judicial process to extensive public scrutiny and criticism. To warrant a finding of prejudicial publicity, there must be allegation and proof that the judges have been unduly influenced, not simply that they might be, by the barrage of publicity. This where the records do not show that the trial judge developed actual bias against the appellant as a consequence of the extensive media coverage of the pretrial and trial of his case, and the totality of circumstances of the case does not prove this actual bias, and he has not discharged the burden. It was held that the appellant was not denied the right to impartial trial. I right to appeal. The accused shall also be entitled to appeal. In all cases and in the manner prescribed by law, appeal is a resort to a superior court to review the decision of an inferior court or administrative agency. An appeal brings up for review errors of judgment committed by a court of competent jurisdiction over the subject of the suit or the persons of the parties, or any such error committed by the court in the exercise of its jurisdiction amounting to nothing more than error of judgment. As a rule, errors of judgment or of procedure not relating to the court's jurisdiction nor involving grave abuse of discretion are reviewable not by certiorari but appeal. The right to appeal is being provided for under Rule 122 of the Revised Rules of Criminal Procedure and Rule 42 and 45 of the Rules of Civil Procedure. Nature and function of appeal. Appeal is an essential part of the judicial system. As such, courts should proceed with caution so as not to deprive a party of the right to appeal, particularly if the appeal is meritorious. But the right to appeal is not a natural right nor a part of due process. It is merely a statutory privilege and may be exercised only in the manner and in accordance with the provisions of the law. But while the right to appeal is statutory and is not provided by the Constitution, once it is granted by statute, its denial would be a violation of the due process clause of the Constitution. For a further discussion of appeal, see annotations under Rule 122.